people laying in first class on the floor, the pilot and the co-pilot, and their throats had been slashed. He asked me if I knew what they wanted, money, ransom, or what. I told him I didn't have a clue.
Lisbeth Glick. Jeremy said he didn't think he was going to make it out. He told me he loved me and our daughter Emerson very much, and he needed us to be happy. He sounded very sad. He kept saying, "I can't believe this is happening to me."
Lisa Jefferson. I asked the caller his name, and he told me, "Todd Beamer from Cranberry, New Jersey."
John Worth. Then the plane started a rapid descent south of Akron.
Lisa Jefferson. The plane took a dive, and he said, "Oh my God, we're going down, we're going down."
Malin Fuller, Pittsburgh Watch Supervisor, FAA. A fellow who was working approach control, Paul Delphine, said, "Mal, I need you real bad." I could tell by the tone of his voice there was something very wrong. I ran over to the radar scope and he pointed, "This airplane's been hijacked over Cleveland. We don't know where he's going." The airplane was going very fast and it was headed directly for the center of the Pittsburgh airport. Without thinking about it, I said, "Evacuate the facility."
Chuck Savall, pilot, Midwest Express Flight 73. We knew how bad things were. I made an announcement to the passengers to let them know that we would try to get them on the ground safe. On the way to Cleveland, we were heading right for Flight 93. Our courses were pretty much head-on. They made us do an emergency descent and land in Pittsburgh.
Colonel Matthew Klimo, we knew Flight 93 was heading to Washington, but no one knew where it was.
Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Nisipany. We had heard that there was a possible other hijack out in Pennsylvania. I had one of the control teams take the Langley aircraft, the F-16s, and start moving them northwest of D.C. We had thrown basically a 30-mile circle around D.C. and made it a restricted area, no fly.
John Worth. Because of the miscommunications somewhere along the line, I think we may have been the only ones who actually knew where he was.
Ben Sliney. We had a report from a small private aircraft pilot who saw a United jet waggling his wings. That threw a lot of ambiguity into this situation because that is a universal signal the pilot has lost radio and is unable to communicate. Even at that late junction, minutes before the aircraft hit the ground in Pennsylvania, we were still wondering whether it was truly hijacked.
Dina Burnett. He called back about 5 minutes till 7. He asked, "Is there anything new?" I said no. He was very quiet this time, very calm. He had been very calm and collected through the other conversations, but he was very solemn in this conversation. He asked, "Where are the kids?" I said, "They're fine. They're sitting at the table. They're asking to talk to you." He said, "Tell them I'll talk to them later."
Time was standing still. The World Trade Center evacuation. As the fateful 9 a.m. hour ticked by, the New York Fire Department launched the biggest response in its history, drawing resources from across its 5 boroughs. Thousands of other first responders and government officials arrived on the scene as well, from local, state, and federal agencies.
Thomas Von Essen, Commissioner, FDNY. Inside the North Tower ground floor lobby, I think we knew less of what was going on than people outside or in the street or the people watching TV.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, Battalion 1, FDNY. We tried every possible means of communication that day, but even cell phones weren't working. Each of the systems we tried failed. I felt very frustrated. It was almost like the closer you were, the less you knew. The helicopters were up, but we had no means to communicate with them. We tried a number of times. We were the least informed.
Stephen Biankowski, Aviation Unit, NYPD. People saw the helicopter, and I'm sure many of them were thinking that we were going to be able to save them. In fact, we weren't able to do anything. We were as close as you could possibly be, and still we were helpless, totally helpless.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. Inside the ground floor lobby of the World Trade Center. Groups of firefighters were coming in. We would brief them, tell them the plan, and send them up. One of the engine companies that came in was Engine 33, which was my brother Kevin's. I told him we thought the lowest level of fire was at floor 78. I told him we didn't have any elevators available. Then we spent a couple seconds looking at each other with a real feeling of concern for each other. Then he knew what he had to do. I watched him walk away, and that was the last time I saw him.
William Jimeno, Officer PAPD. Sergeant John McLaughlin ran up to us and said, I need volunteers to go in with us, and I need people who know how to use Scott air packs, the breathing apparatuses that the firefighters use. Port Authority police officers are cross-trained not only for law enforcement, but firefighting. I don't know which of us said it first, either Dominic Pizzullo, Antonio Rodriguez, or me, but one of us said, we just graduated, we know how to use it. Sergeant McLaughlin said, that's good, that's four of us, we're going to go. We started running toward the building. I remember thinking to myself, wow, this is bad.
James Luongo, Inspector, NYPD. As I hit VC between Church and Broadway, the first thing that struck me was the amount of women's shoes. I couldn't understand it. Then I realized women had run out of their shoes, the high heels and what have you. There were women's shoes all over.
Sergeant Anthony Lisi, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 6, NYPD. Sergeant Tom Sullivan stopped us and said, we have hundreds of firemen and cops in the building already doing rescue work. I want you to stop, take off that gear, and put on your heavy vest and helmet and grab weapons because we're getting word that they're shooting civilians as they're running out of the building. We were over our radio getting reports of shots fired at the Trade Center. It winds up, it was police officers who were shooting out the windows so more people could run out faster. There were shots fired, but by good guys, not bad guys.
Sharon Miller, officer, PAPD. Before we got out of the car, me, Richie Rodriguez, Jimmy Nelson, and Jimmy Parham, we all held hands and we said, we're going in together, we're going to come out together.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Engine 16 FDNY. I huddled the guys together because I knew this was going to be a tough day. I got into a little huddle like football players do. I says, come here. I says, just treat this like a fire. We'll stick together. Watch each other's back.
Captain J. Jonas. I walked over to my crew and I says, okay, guys, here's the deal. It's a raw deal, but this is what we have to do. I said, we have to go upstairs in this building for search and rescue. Then I said, and I forgot I made this one statement, but all my guys swear that I said it. They said, I said, they're trying to kill us, boys, so let's go. And they did, to their credit. I don't think anybody would have looked down on them if they ran up West Street. As we were about to hit the stairway, Sal D'Agostino said to me, hey, Cap, I wonder where the Air Force is. I says, yeah. I wonder how many thousands of fires I've been to in my career, and I've never hit a stairway wondering where the Air Force was. We were hoping they had our backs.
William Jimeno. In the midst of all this chaos, all this disaster, inside that World Trade Center, there were people helping each other. I remember seeing a black gentleman with a white gentleman carrying this blonde woman who had a severe cut on her leg. I remember thinking to myself, Will, if these normal civilians can be this brave, we as rescue workers, we need to be three steps above them because they're counting on us.
James Luongo, Inspector, NYPD. There were a bunch of people who came out of the building on VC Street. They were a little disoriented about which way to go. I started yelling to them to come to me. They were looking around. Finally, a woman heard my voice. She touched the people next to her. She pointed to where me and Dennis and Sergeant Boodle were. And with that, debris came down and killed all of them. With all the things I saw that day, that to me was the worst. Because those people were so close. But yet they didn't make it.
William Jimeno. As we walked into the Port Authority police desk at the base of the towers, I remember being stunned by a piece of the fuselage that our detectives had brought in. Your mind is trying to register, even though you know that a plane had hit. Why is there a piece of the plane here?
James Luongo. Quite a few people came to the site looking to go in because their loved ones were there. I remember one woman standing on the corner by VC and West, and I told her that she had to leave.
She said, I'm not leaving. We were back and forth like this for a second or two. I said, I hope he's worth your life, because you're not going to be able to get to him. She said, he is worth my life. She looked to walk past me. I stopped her, and she pushed me. I grabbed her and picked her up to walk with her. She was hitting me as I was walking away. Let me in. Let me go. I gotta go there.
William Jimeno. Christopher Amoroso, someone that we had worked with and really liked, good cop, said, Sarge, can I hook you up with guys? Sarge said, yeah, Chris, you can. Christopher had an injury over his left eye, and we asked him what happened. Something hit my eye, probably a piece of concrete. We've got to keep working. Sergeant McLaughlin had asked another officer, Anthony Rodriguez, to meet us up at Tower 2. Unfortunately for Anthony, one of the victims that fell from the building hit too close to him. He had human remains on his body. He said, Sarge, I can't work in this. Sarge told him, go change your uniform and meet us up by Tower 2. At that point, we became five.
Inside both towers, each now fatally stricken, their seemingly impregnable structures burning, melting, and weakening under temperatures that reached 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, thousands of evacuating office workers rushed to exit their building, even as firefighters and police officers worked their way inside to provide aid.
Richard Eichen. I got to a neighboring office and met Charlie Egan, their systems administrator, and he was annoyed because the explosion knocked off his servers. He was going to stay until midnight, bringing his servers all back up. I remember going with Charlie into the server room and saying, look, if it means anything, I'll stay with you, and together we'll get these things back up. He was really annoyed. Then he said, I better call the building. He called down there and goes, hi, this is so-and-so, Clearstream Banking. I think he gave his name. There are five of us here. We're on the 90th floor. The office building said, stay there. We know where you are. Meanwhile, we're looking out the window, and we can see large chunks of the building falling, huge chunks of the building, the size of, like, trucks falling. And it's like, well, I really don't think that's a viable option.
Herb Ouida, World Trade Centers Association, North Tower, 77th floor, and father of Todd Ouida, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 105th floor. I thought my son Todd was on the stairs. Todd called his mother immediately when the plane hit. He said to her, Mommy, don't worry. You're going to hear there was an explosion at the World Trade Center. I'm going to take the stairs. She said, What about Daddy? Todd said, I just spoke to him. He's all right. Todd had not spoken to me. He was a kid who had suffered as a child from anxiety disorder, panic attacks, and at the moment of greatest danger, he's protecting his mother. He was 25 years old.
Judith Wine. I was literally walking over bodies. So many people died at that moment of impact. The way they landed, maybe they broke their necks or something. Some other guy came up. We later found out his name was Wells Crowther, and he'd been a volunteer fireman upstate, and he asked where there was a fire extinguisher. I pointed to where it was, and he went to get it. He was running different places and trying to put out fires. He had a red bandana on his face. He was calm and commanding. This is what we have to do. This is what needs to be done. He directed people to the only open working staircase, the only one that went all the way down. He stayed up there and helped, and didn't make it out.
Bruno Dellinger, Principal, Quintamassis, North America, North Tower, 47th floor. Suddenly, I felt the urge to go, and I dropped everything and left.
Stanley Peremnith, Fuji Bank, South Tower, 81st floor. I crawled the entire length of the loans department, the lounge, the computer room, the communication room. That's as far as I can go. I can't go any further because one lousy sheetrock wall stood firm.
Ryan Clark, Executive Vice President, Eurobrokers, South Tower. Our offices occupied the entire 84th floor. Everything was destroyed. I started down with this group of six people following me with my flashlight. We only went three floors down to the 81st floor when I was distracted by this banging noise. I heard, help, I'm buried, I can't breathe.
Stanley Peremnath. This man behind the wall was saying, I can hear your voice. Bang on the wall. I'll know where you are. He said, climb over the sheetrock wall. I said, I can't. He said, you've got to think of your family. If you want to live, you must do it.
Brian Clark. Suddenly he said, can you see my hand? He was waving his hand down by the floor. I shined my flashlight on it and followed it up the arm to see his two eyes through this hole in the wall. He scrambled up. I missed him the first time, but the second time he jumped up, I caught him and heaved him up and over the wall. We fell back down on the ground, him on top of me. He gave me this big kiss, and I said, I'm Brian. He said, I'm Stanley.
Stanley Peremnath. He said, come on, buddy, let's go home.
Roughly 1,100 people were trapped above the impact zones across both the North and South Towers. As conditions worsened and smoke and fire permeated the upper floors, they dialed 911, emergency services, and the Port Authority's World Trade Center command post, hoping to speed rescuers to their aid, not realizing how dire their situation actually was. For 20 minutes, 32-year-old Melissa Doy, trapped on the 83rd floor of the South Tower, spoke to a 911 operator waiting for rescue. She told the operator, it's very hot everywhere on the floor. All I see is smoke. Christine Olander, the assistant general manager at Windows on the World, reached the Port Authority Command Center and reported that the stairwells were too smoky to evacuate. She said, we have most people on the 106th floor. The 107th floor is way too smoky. We need direction as to where we need to direct our guests and our employees as soon as possible. Port Authority Police Officer Steve Maggett told her that rescuers were doing their best to get up to the top. He said, everybody is on their way. He suggested she call back in a few minutes and he might have more news to share. Back inside the stairwells of the North and South Towers, civilians and rescuers mixed in single-file lines, each group tired and sweaty from the exertions behind and ahead. As one group descended to evacuate, the others continued to climb, determined to help anyone still trapped.
Richard Eichen. The five of us went out. My coworker, Lucy, sat down and said, I'm not going anywhere. I said, Lucy, we're not leaving anybody behind. We've got to get out of here. We're starting to burn. I put her hands on my shoulders. She stood behind me. I put her hands on my shoulders and held her hands so she wouldn't let go. I said, come on. I said, I'm hurt. I need help. I don't want to die by myself. I need help. I did that to get her to go. Then together, we went out. We actually caught stairwell A, which it turned out was the only viable staircase up there.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. We were ordered to the 23rd floor in the North Tower to report into some other command post. We entered stairway B, which was the core stairway in the building. As we were going up, the people in the building were coming down, and actually it was very smooth.
Stephen Blahar, Officer Emergency Service Unit, Truck 10 NYPD. We made it to the 9th floor of the North Tower, and I remember filling a coffee pot with water and grabbing some plastic cups for everybody. Because by that time, we were hot and sweaty, and I knew we were going up at least another 70 floors.
Dave and Norman, there were people waiting on floors on the way up. We were informing them, you need to leave. You need to continue flowing down the staircase. Don't obstruct the staircase flow. Continue to move.
Captain J. Jonas, you had a row of firemen going up the stairs, and you had a row of civilians coming down the stairs.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, we carry a lot of equipment. We carry 60, 70 pounds of equipment with us on average. It's a little slow going up the stairs, and it was hot that day. We stopped about every 5 floors and took a little breather.
Peter Bitwinski. We encountered maybe 20 to 25 firemen. It's one of the sadder memories I have of that day. They were walking up with full equipment, these big metal picks, and they were sweating like crazy.
Kathy Pavlik. As they walk past us, both of my brothers are firemen in New Jersey, I was very careful to say, Hello, thank you, God bless you, to every single one of them. They were huffing and puffing, and these were big, strong guys.
Herbuida. The stairways were much better lit this time than in the 93 bombing, and unlike 93, there was no smoke coming up because the explosion was above us. New Yorkers were very brave that day. People helped each other. We were saying, déjà vu. We were trying to encourage each other and say, oh, we've been through this before. We didn't realize this was different. None of us realized the building was going to collapse.
Dave and Norman. When we got to floor 31, we found probably about a half dozen or more firefighters, one or two civilians on that floor dealing with chest pains, exhaustion, and stuff like that. We looked at each other and said, we already have a triage set up here for us. This was our mission. Why don't we stay here?
Sharon Miller. We stopped on the 27th floor. That's when I said to my supervisor, PAPD Captain Kathy Mazza, hey, Kat, I really love my job, but this is getting bad. I said, I'm really not ready to die yet. She goes, oh, don't worry about it. We'll be fine. I said, well, how about a hug? And we hugged. Then she goes, all right, that's enough of that.
Judith Wine. I walked down with another man. He actually had a severed arm, which we didn't know about because he was wearing a suit. It kept his arm in. He was holding on to the lower part of his arm, but I didn't think anything of that.
Bruno Dellinger. The heat was quite intense in the stairwell. There were some people who took their shirts off. The intensity of the warning signs, the fire alarms were in full force, like stroboscopic lamps, and the fire alarm sound was pounding you all the time.
Judith Wine. We're walking down the stairs, and around floor 40, some rescue workers came in, and they said we should sit and rest. The two others went to sit on the stairs, and I went to sit down. I had my tush sticking out, getting ready to sit, and something inside me said, don't sit. It almost felt like somebody had an arm or a hand on my back, pushing me up. It was a weird feeling, just don't sit. I said, look, if you guys are tired, you sit, but I can't sit. Because I didn't sit, they got up, and we walked. The rescue workers walked us through somebody's office to an internal elevator, which was working, and so we went from about 40 down to the lobby. I was told later that we were the last group of people to go down in that elevator.
Elia Zedeno, financial analyst, Port Authority, North Tower, 73rd floor. Most of my journey down the stairs was in this complete state of non-emotion. I saw people injured, but I had no reaction. I remember moving to the side and letting them walk in front of us. I remember a woman who was screaming and screaming and screaming. I couldn't really completely understand what she was saying, but there was a man helping her, and he had blood on his forehead, and all he kept saying to her was, we were the lucky ones. We were the lucky ones. He kept repeating that. I was thinking, what in the world did this woman see?
Peter Bitwinski. We started to make our way down the staircase with John Abruzzo in the evacuchair. We had to get a routine going, so we decided two people on the bottom would hold the evacuchair with two people at the top. We had eight people who were actively taking him down, four people at a time.
John Abruzzo. We wanted to make time, but they were not absolutely sure how the chair worked or how it would handle. I don't think the manufacturer even thought about the chair going down 69 flights.
Peter Bitwinski. We kept switching our team. The two guys holding the handles on top of the evacuchair would move to the bottom of the evacuchair after five flights. Then after you were on the bottom, you would move off the chair and two other guys would take your place. You'd be free of chair duty for 5 or 10 floors.
John Abruzzo. The firemen cheered us on, encouraging us. Keep on going, they said. You're doing a good job. Keep going.
Marcel Clath, firefighter, engine 24, FDNY. I just kept climbing. I knew it was going to be a hard day, but I kept thinking about putting water on the fire.
Bruno Dellinger. While I was walking down, they were going up to their deaths, and I was walking down to live. I will never forget this.
Lila Spessener. That will stay with me forever. They were going where we were running from.
despite the fact that an incident had occurred within the building, not many companies formally evacuated their staff. Many of the early evacuees had made the decision on their own to leave. In the South Tower, however, Morgan Stanley's efforts likely saved scores or even hundreds of lives. The company had invested heavily in evacuation equipment and training following the 1993 bombing, and its security chief, a former British paratrooper-turned-Vietnam veteran named Rick Riscorla, ignored the Port Authority's initial announcement that those in the South Tower could remain at their desks. Riscorla's experience told him otherwise. He left a voicemail for his best friend, Dan Hill, saying, "The dumb sons of bitches told me not to evacuate. They said it's just Building 1. I told them I'm getting my people the fuck out of here." Then he immediately began working feverishly to ensure everyone escaped.
Janine Ali, controller, Morgan Stanley, South Tower, 45th floor. On September 11th, our security department were the ones that got all of the Morgan Stanley employees out of the offices. With bullhorns, our security was saying, "Evacuate the building now." I remember them saying specifically, "You have to evacuate the building now."
Robert Small. As we were going down, we get down to the 40s and we run into Rick Riscorla. I knew him through the fire safety training. He was always a jovial Scottish guy, always fun, had the brogue. He wasn't fun that day. I tried to be humorous, passing him, saying, "Hey, I'm the last man off 72. You don't have to go check it. Everyone's gone." He goes, "Just get out. Just go. Just get out." His tone was dead on serious. I'd never seen him that serious before.
Barbara Fiorillo, manager, Mercer Consulting, South Tower, 54th floor. We heard voices of people directing the flow of traffic. There were very strong male voices, "Speed up, slow down, speed up, slow down." It turns out that we were in the same elevator bank as Morgan Stanley, and they had worked at the tower in the first bombing. They had enormous training and experience. The voice directing the traffic was such a calming effect.
Robert Small. We came across a man, a big man. I hate to use the word fat, but he was. He was huge, and he was struggling on the stairs, and he was holding onto the banister with both hands. I offered him some water. He said, "I can't take your bottle of water." I dropped my bag, opened it up, and he saw that I had dozens of bottles. He took a couple. We sat there with him and were talking. He didn't say who he was or what floor he had started on. He didn't have it in him. I said, "When you're ready, we'll go together, and James and I will get you down." He said, No. Do me a favor. If you see anybody, rescue or fireman, let them know where I am." I felt bad leaving him. We left him 3-4 bottles of water, and we said goodbye.
As the morning unfolded, Riscorla called his wife, Susan, and told her, "I don't want you to cry. I have to evacuate my people now. If something happens to me, I want you to know that you made my life." His efforts that day were credited with saving numerous lives. Ultimately, only 6 Morgan Stanley employees out of more than 2,700 in the World Trade Center died on September 11th. Riscorla and 2 of his fellow security personnel were among those 6. He was last seen on the 10th floor, heading upstairs.
Richard Eichen. As you got lower and lower, you got into more and more people. I was afraid that it was getting congested. I wasn't afraid of the buildings falling. I was afraid of panic.
Vanessa Lawrence. If the flow stopped for too long, people shouted out, "Don't worry, people congestion."
Bruno Dellinger. It taught me something about human beings in distress. We were receiving from everywhere around us warning signs that this was a very, very dangerous situation. The moment we got those messages, something inside, a defense mechanism, kicked in and stopped us from panicking.
Robert Small. As we're into maybe the 20s, we came across 2 women, one helping the other. The one doing all the help was also burdened with bags. She was helping a woman who she said was 4 months pregnant. "Okay, let us help you. Let us carry the bags." She let us carry the bags, but now the pregnant woman wanted to stop. We gave her some water. She says she's hot. I took some water out, made a little rag, sponging her back and her neck, making her feel a little bit better. She was finally ready to go. No sooner did we get a couple floors down than she wanted to stop. Like football coaching. When you tell a kid to do a push-up, you always try to get one more out of them. I told her, give me one more floor, then we'll stop. I'll give you water. Give me one more floor. And we did.
Constance Libetti. I would start to cry, and I'd start to tremble, and I heard my father's voice. My father had been dead since 1985, and I heard his voice, clear as day, telling me that I was not going to die in this building. I straightened up and kept walking down the steps. A few minutes later, I heard my uncle, who kind of took over being my dad when my dad passed away. My uncle passed away in 99, and he used to call me kiddo. I heard my uncle's voice in my left ear telling me, kiddo, just take one step at a time. And I did.
Richard Eichen. When we finally got down to the 20s, we saw our first firefighter coming up. At this point, Lucy was lying on a landing. She pretty much passed out. The firefighter said, we've set up a station a couple of floors down. We carried her spread eagle. I carried her legs. He carried her under her armpits. The two of us carried her down the stairwell, maybe two floors. When we got to the aid station, they asked me if I was okay, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. I met Lieutenant Glenn Wilkerson, who unfortunately didn't make it out. We were about 3 feet from each other, and he said, what's it like up there? I told him what it was like.
Robert Small. We got down to the fifth floor. Everything's fine. The ladies are fine. All of a sudden, we heard, New York City Police, anybody here? So we called out. It was a female officer, and I'm assuming a male detective because he was in a suit. She and the detective wanted to help us out. I was very adamant, saying, don't need your help. I said, I've been coming down since 72. I got this far. 5 more flights. We told them about the gentleman upstairs and Rick on the 44th floor, and they headed up. You could hear them, floor by floor, opening doors, screaming out if anyone needed assistance, and then slamming the doors and going up to the next level. I know she didn't make it. It always bothered me that she didn't make it, because if she did help us, would that have kept her out?
Richard Eichen. They had given Lucy some oxygen. She was coming around, and she was feeling better. And at some point, she said, all right, I'm ready. Lucy, are you sure? Yeah, I'm ready. Okay. So we got up. I took her hand. We go back to the stairwell. We continued going down.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. We encountered a group of people who were non-ambulatory. We started to assist these people, trying to get them down. Me and Andy, from Engine 1, had somebody between us, a woman, and she was going very slowly, one step at a time. I wanted to get out of that building. It was like time was standing still.
Frank Lombardi, Chief Engineer, Port Authority, North Tower. Water was starting to run into the stairwells. The sprinkler systems must have been turned on, and we had to watch our footing to make sure that we wouldn't slip.
Richard Eichen. It was pretty deep water, mid-calf to below the knee. All the water had gone down and collected there. It's like, wow, this is like a sinking ship. What the hell? Finally, a few more stairs, and we got into the lobby.
Linda Kruner, Senior Vice President, Fiduciary Trust, South Tower. We got to the ground level. We got out of the elevator and looked out at the plaza area. My first thought was, this is Britain during the Blitz, because that's really what it looked like.
Robert Small. We got down to the main level. We were being escorted. It was like Hansel and Gretel with the breadcrumbs. A human line of police and rescue and you name it. They said, come this way, exit to the north.
Constance Libetti. We got to the lobby, and my coworker Jules and I had to rest for a moment because we were perspiring terribly. We had walked down 100 flights of steps. People were coming up to me, hugging me and telling me, thank you, and hugging me as they walked by me. And I said to Jules, what? Why? What are they doing that for? She said, Connie, you don't know what you were saying? You were saying, we're not going to die in this building. Just take it one step at a time. I was repeating what my father and my uncle were telling me, and I didn't even know it.
At the High School for Leadership and Public Service, a block south of the South Tower, students and teachers try to figure out an evacuation plan. Eventually, the occupants of the school and its neighbor, the High School of Economics and Finance, fled four blocks south, along with thousands of other people in Lower Manhattan, to Battery Park, at the tip of Manhattan.
Robert Rosado, student, HSLPS. Miss Ordover asked us to write about what we thought had happened while she went online.
Heather Ordover. The lead photo on CNN's webpage was what we couldn't see from my classroom. The north side of the North Tower with an enormous gaping hole.
Ada Dulch, principal, HSLPS. Panic was beginning to set in. People were streaming into our lobby. Parents started coming in. I want my child. I stood up on the table in the lobby and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am the principal of the school." I said, "No one is allowed to go upstairs." There was this sense of, I got to take care of my chickadees, and all my kitties were upstairs safe.
Rezvan Hotarano, student, HSLPS. I knew that whatever happened, I needed to get home fast. I knew my mom must have been very worried for me.
Ada Dulch. When the second tower was hit, our building really shook. A piece of the plane fell in front of our school building. Debris was falling on our rooftop. We could see flying paper on fire.
Ketora Bostic. I knew I was going to die. It seemed like there was no hope in the world. I found some friends. We all prayed and told each other that we loved each other. Next, I pulled out a paper and started to write a letter to my family members, telling them how much I love them.
Ada Dulch. Where would we go? Where can you congregate with a lot of children? I said, oh, I know where we're going. We're going to Battery Park. We initiated an evacuation plan. I had my assistant principals go floor by floor and evacuate all the students. I stood at the outside door and simply said to them, hold each other's hands, stay together. I would say to them, you should pray. This is a good time to be praying and to ask God for mercy that we will be safe.
Rosmaris Fernandez, student, HSLPS. I led the group to Battery Park.
Ketora Bostic. We ran, thinking that the worst was over, and after that, nothing else could go wrong.
Tim Sito, student, HSLPS. We walked toward Battery Park. There was all this debris on the ground, newspapers, ashes, and burned stuff. The towers looked like two smoldering cigarettes pointed upward.
Heather Ordover. A student and I picked up pieces of honeycomb insulation. I picked up someone's insurance policy, burnt in half and charred around the edges.
Ada Dulch. The kids were in total shock. They were very scared. They were catatonic.
Heather Ordover. We hustled them down to the edge of Battery Park. I stood on a bench with Liz Collins, a math teacher. The kids rallied around us.
Dan Potter. As I get off the Verrazano Bridge, there was a bus lane and police vehicles were shooting through it. I got right behind them. Cop was standing right in front of me, so I held my badge out the window and he flagged me through. We were in a convoy of police vehicles doing about 70 miles an hour between two barriers all the way through.
Jean Potter, Bank of America, North Tower. We were going down, but again, there was smoke. Everything was lit. The staircase was lit. Smoke in the air. The smell of jet fuel. We were making our way down pretty quickly, and then it started to bottleneck a little bit. We started seeing firemen come up in the 20s. That's when I saw FDNY Captain Vinny Giamona. I grabbed his arm and said, Vinny, be safe. I knew that he was not going to make it out.
Dan Potter, I didn't think that these towers were going to collapse. This was the massive, biggest fire I've ever seen, but as you're calculating, you don't really know the extent of the damage. I was convinced that we'll get up there and put it out.
Jean Potter, we're getting down to like 11, 10, and on like 8, I started yelling at people to move. I don't ordinarily yell. I'm a very soft-spoken individual. But I started screaming at people. Move it! Move it! We're almost out of here! Move it! Move it! The lobby was completely devastated. There was glass all over.
Dan Potter. When I got up West Street, just about Rector Street, I noticed police starting to put some barriers out. I noticed body parts in the street. There were big pieces and smaller pieces. I looked up at the Trade Center and I could see the flames, see the firemen. I wondered, where is she? Where could she possibly be? I thought, she's got to be up on the roof. I was convinced at this point that she's up on the roof. I was going to do the best I could to get a team together and get up there.
Jean Potter. They took us down into the concourse. I'm so grateful I kept my shoes on because the water was ankle deep and there was broken glass all over. There was a human chain of emergency workers yelling at us, run, run, run! When do they tell you to run in an emergency? It was so horrifying.
Richard Eichen. When we got into the lobby, it was really scary. It looked like someone dumped a barbecue on it. It was covered in ash. I remember hearing the water dripping, dripping, dripping.
Janine Ali. They were directing people out, up through borders and out toward Five World Trade. There was a fireman. He couldn't have been more than 19 years old, with a hose on his shoulder. I remember looking at him and saying to him, there's nothing you can do. Don't go in there. He said, lady, it's my job. I have to do it.
Linda Crooner. I got out and crossed the street. The first thing that hit me was the sounds. There were so many sounds. There were sirens and people screaming. It was like you were in the middle of one of those action movies with everything coming apart at the same time. Fire engines, the ambulances, the police, and people shouting.
Richard Eichen. As we got closer to the door, there were security guards helping guide people out. I think they were some of the bravest people, unsung heroes of 9/11, because they could have run away. This was way beyond their pay grade. But they stayed.
Ralph Blasi, Director of Security, Brookfield Properties, owner of the World Financial Center and One Liberty Plaza. I have the greatest admiration for the private security officers, guys who are only making about $25,000 a year. We had often asked security guards, prior to 9/11, what they would do if a bomb went off and they saw a couple dead bodies. The consensus was always that they would run. But on September 11th, I had 60 guards working with me and not one ran. With the two towers burning, standing with bullhorns, keeping people moving out of the towers, they never blinked.
The sun was shining on them. Jumping. Amid the catastrophe at the World Trade Center, no sight left as powerful an impression on rescuers, officials, and evacuees as the developing tragedy of victims trapped without escape on the tower's upper floors, caught amid rising, unbearable temperatures and deadly smoke, who fell or chose to jump.
Wesley Wong, Assistant Special Agent in Charge, FBI New York. This fireman said something to me that I didn't understand. He said, watch out for the falling bodies. I remember crossing West Street and thinking, what did he say about falling bodies? I said, it's a fire. As I got close to the building, this fireman from behind yelled, run, here comes one. I froze and I looked up over my right shoulder, up into that beautiful, bright blue sky. I saw a fellow spread eagle coming out of the sky. He had on navy blue dress pants, a white shirt, and a tie. Dark hair. I couldn't believe what I saw.
Detective David Brink. There were a lot of bodies that were coming down. I saw daisy chains of four people holding hands, just leaping out of the buildings. I kept looking up, saying, I want to help you guys, hold on, please, hold on. But I knew there was nothing I could do. I felt so helpless and powerless.
Dr. Charles Hirsch, Chief Medical Examiner, City of New York. It was a sight and sound
that I'll never forget. The awful sound of people impacting.
Gregory Freed, Executive Chief Surgeon, NYPD. You'd hear this whoosh, and then it would go crash. And then all of a sudden you'd hear a splat. One of the cops said to me, "What was that?" I looked at him and said, "That was a person."
Quentin DeMarco, officer, PAPD. The clothes of the jumpers sounded like a flag or a sail in a windstorm.
Bill Spade, firefighter, Rescue 5, FDNY. There were motion detector doors that opened up into the North Tower. These doors kept opening and closing with the bodies that were coming down.
Peter Moog, officer, NYPD. I did see one jumper actually hit a fireman on the corner near Vesey and West. I later found out that the fireman was Danny Sir. He played for the fire department football team. I coach our team, and I've played, so I knew Danny. He's one of the first firemen to get killed.
William Jimeno. The one that struck me the most, it's almost like my eyes could zoom in up to him. It was a blonde gentleman wearing a pair of khakis and a light pink shirt, college shirt. And when he jumped almost like he was on a cross, like Jesus. He jumped, looking up in the air, and he went down.
Stanley Trojanowski, firefighter, engine 238, FDNY. I must have blessed myself between 40 and 50 times, once for each jumper.
Bill Spade. We've seen death at other things, but this time it was something different. There were so many, so many.
Sergeant Mike McGovern. I had blood splatter on the cuffs of my pants from the people jumping and landing on the ground.
Rudy Giuliani. All of a sudden, I saw a man at a window. Must have been the 100th floor, 101st, 102nd floor, North Tower. He threw himself out the window. I froze, stopped, and watched him come all the way down. It was a totally shocking experience, unlike any I've ever had before. I leaned over to the police commissioner and said, "This is much worse than we thought. It's off the charts." We had practiced a lot of things: anthrax, sarin gas, airplane crashes, building collapses, hostage situations, derailed trains, West Nile virus. I was pretty confident that we were the most prepared place in the United States for any emergency, maybe in the world. This was beyond anything that anybody had imagined.
Bernie Carrick. I've been in this business 26 years, and I've done everything under the sun. I've been involved in gun battles, have had partners who were killed. But I've never felt as helpless as I did on that morning. You couldn't yell to these people and ask them to stop or make them stop.
Melinda Murphy, traffic reporter, WPIX-TV, airborne over New York Harbor. Our camera's pretty strong. I said, "What's that dripping off the building?" It looked like something was dripping. Chet's like, "I don't know." So we zoom in and we could see people jumping. We were on live TV and I remember going, "Okay, that's it. Zoom out. Zoom out." I didn't want anybody to see it.
Sonny Mindell, communications director for the mayor of the city of New York, Rudy Giuliani. I remember seeing colleagues from the police department's press operations surrounded by television cameras with their lenses trained upward on people jumping. The first thing you learn when you do what I do is you never obscure the lens of a camera. That's a violation of the First Amendment, to interfere with the press. I was so riveted to this moment of people making this decision to jump that my gut instinct was, this is an invasion of the most intimate moment ever. My hands started to go up to block the lenses, but then I thought, no, this has got to be recorded for history. I just stood there.
When is this going to come to an end? The FAA makes history. At 9:42 a.m., 5 minutes after the Pentagon attack, the FAA issued an unprecedented order. Every plane in the country must land immediately. Beyond the massive disruption in the airspace over the United States, More than 100 transatlantic flights were diverted to small airports in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and elsewhere in Canada. Pilots, flight crews, and passengers all tried to understand what had happened in the United States, hungry for information wherever they could find it.
Ben Sliney, National Operations Manager, FAA Command Center, Herndon, Virginia. I said, "That's it," I said. "I'm landing everyone." I remember a colleague putting his hand out to grab my shoulder, and he said, "Wait a minute. Do you want to think about that?" I said, "I've already thought about it, and I'm going to do it."
Dan Creedon, Departure Controller, TRACON, Reagan National Airport, Washington, D.C. As soon as Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, it was obvious that no one should get near Washington. We could not trust any crew.
Ben Sliney. I walked down to the middle of the floor, and everyone came over to me. I said, "We're going to land everyone at the nearest airport, regardless of destination."
Major General Larry Arnold. Boston Center had stopped all takeoffs, then the Department of Transportation stopped all flights, and then my boss declared SCATANA, which stands for Security Control of Air Traffic and Air Navigation Aids. It means the military is taking control of all the navigation aids and of the airspace. Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Nisipany. I feel I'm still so far behind on what's happening, the whole situation. It's a catch-up situation, and I don't like being in a catch-up situation. Never have, never will.
Terry Vigio, Operations Manager, Boston Air Route Traffic Control Center. The controllers were telling the pilots, "You're gonna have to land." We told them, "You're not leaving our airspace. You're gonna have to pick an airport. Get a hold of your company, tell us where you're gonna go, and tell us where you're gonna land."
Christy Ludke, Chief of Air Traffic Control Training, Johnstown, Cambria County Airport, Pennsylvania. Cleveland Center said, "We are bringing everybody in. Everybody's landing."
Gerald Earwood, pilot Midwest Express Flight 7. Every plane was considered a threat. We were asked probably 15 or 20 times, "Are you still with us?" It was total mass confusion.
Major General Larry Arnold. The only thing I can equate it to is when I was at Da Nang. Da Nang became known as Rocket City by attacks by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. I was there during three of those attacks. If I could explain to you how it was on 9/11, we were under attack. You don't know when it's going to end. You're getting calls. Turned out to be 21 aircraft or 22. We were never sure whether it was 21 or 22, but we were keeping track, writing with grease pencils every time one was called potentially hijacked, meaning something was going on with this aircraft. I felt like we were under attack, like it was when I was hearing the rockets coming in when I was at Da Nang. When is this going to come to an end?
Ben Sliney. When the order came out to land at the nearest airport, regardless of destination, I expected some pushback. Out of 4,500 aircraft in the air, I only got one request to land at an airport that was not the nearest one. I refused the request.
Dan Creedon. To put 4,500 aircraft on the ground in places where they were not supposed to go, at the same time that the military is trying to get airborne and control the chaos, is an incredible feat of air traffic controllers and air traffic managers coordinating that.
George Bill Keaton, Air Traffic Controller, Cleveland Center. A couple times that day, my voice did crack a little bit on frequency when I was working, and it bothered me that the professionalism slipped a little bit. But it was a very emotional time. I saw people in the aisles crying.
Ben Sliney. To give some perspective, I believe 700 landed within the first 10 minutes and 3,500 within the first hour.
Terry Biggio. They did an incredible job under warlike conditions with unbelievable precision.
Ben Sliney. I do not think the aviation industry got the thanks that they deserve from the American public.
Rick Grayson, passenger, ATA Airlines, Chicago to Orlando. About 30 or 40 minutes into the flight, after level-off, I heard the engines throttle back to idle and felt the plane making a very rapid descent. The captain came on the PA and announced that, due to a national emergency, all airspace in the United States had been shut down. and that we would be landing in Louisville very shortly. My teenage daughter read the look on my face and said, "Dad, what is it?" I told her I didn't know, but told her to lower her window shade. I guess I was expecting incoming nukes and wanted to protect her from the flash. Silly how one's mind thinks of such things, as though that would have done a damned bit of good.
Bob Schnarrenberger, flight attendant, U.S. Airways, Pittsburgh to London. Our lead flight attendant came through the cabin. She said, "Bob, I need you to tighten down the galleys, put everything away, lock up all your carts, finish your service in 45 minutes. She left for the back of the airplane, and I'm thinking, okay, what's going on? I pried, and she took me aside and told me there was a critical situation in the U.S. and that the U.S. was under siege. Those were her words. I can remember them as if it was just yesterday. We were diverted to a little town called Stephenville in Newfoundland. There were 5 other jumbo jets on the ground there from all over. We were the last one that landed."
Jackie Pinto, passenger, Milan to Newark. The pilot made an announcement that we were going to be delayed. Our landing was going to be delayed. Then things progressed, and he made an announcement and said, "We're not going to be landing in Newark today." That, of course, was peculiar, but I didn't think anything odd. As soon as we landed, they made the announcement that we landed in Gander, Newfoundland, which I had never heard of.
Gerald Earwood. We were the next to last aircraft to land at LaGuardia. They put us on a taxiway, pointing at the World Trade Center, watching the World Trade Center burn.
You're going to get out. The Trade Center rescue continues. At the World Trade Center, the first crowds to evacuate the damaged buildings emerged onto the adjacent plazas and streets to find horrors anew. Few realized, though, that the clock was ticking, and they had mere minutes to escape the scene.
Michael Jacobs, investment banker, May Davis Group, North Tower, 87th floor. Everyone from my company got out but one, Harry Ramos, and he died a hero's death. Harry was the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. He was helping my coworkers get down, and on the way they came across an obese man who had given up. Harry and another of our workers, Hong Zhu, started down with him. They got as far as 30-something, but the guy gave up again. The fireman yelled, "Come on, get up, get up." The fireman walking up the stairs told Hong and Harry, "If you won't go, you guys get the hell out." Hong got scared. He said, "Come on, Harry, let's go." Harry said, "No, I'm going to stay with him." He did. Hong got out. They haven't found Harry.
The man Harry Ramos waited with was Victor Wald, a 49-year-old New York stockbroker with Avalon Partners and father of two. Wald had only started working at Avalon in late August. Later, Ramos's and Wald's families would request that their names be placed together on the 9/11 memorial.
Howard Lutnick, CEO, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I stood at the door off of Church Street. People were coming out, and I was yelling at them to run. I would ask them what floor they were coming from. Someone would scream 55, and I would scream, "We're at 55. Because I kept wanting to get numbers higher up the building from my office's floors, 101 through 105. I got to the 91st floor.
Jimmy Mayo, driver for Howard Lutnick. There was nothing we could do. I wasn't so concerned for our safety because I thought the deed had been done.
Elia Zedeno. I saw debris all along the outside perimeter of the building. I was looking and thinking, oh my God, this is more than what I thought. My eyes start to focus a little bit more. I realized I was looking at bodies.
Joe Massian, technology consultant, Port Authority, North Tower, 70th floor. I remember stepping out of the building. My coworker Larry and I were helping our colleague Teresa. Each of us had one of her arms. I remember taking a minute, looking back up. I said to Larry, "You've got to see this. Hollywood could never make this in a movie."
Constance Labetti, accountant, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 99th floor. The debris, the blocks of concrete, the fires. I saw shoes and briefcases. We thought we were in a war zone. We all gasped.
We couldn't believe what we were seeing.
Harry Weiser, Tax Counsel, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 104th floor. Once I lay down in the ambulance, I did start to feel something. I literally did not feel pain before then. I started feeling chilled pain. I started trembling. I was shaking, chattering.
Bruno Dellinger. What we went through will haunt us until the end of our lives.
Near the base of the World Trade Center, New York City's leaders continued to search for an acceptable command post from which to oversee the rescue effort and formulate the city's response.
Sergeant Mike McGovern, we ended up, the chief, the mayor, the police commissioner, the first deputy, the commissioner of operations, ended up in this office building on the corner of West Broadway and Barclay.
Rudy Giuliani, the police commissioner, and I discussed the actions he had taken. He said, I closed the tunnels and the bridges. Nobody else can be allowed into Manhattan. I said, are we covering our priority targets?
Joe Esposito, chief of department, NYPD. The order was evacuate all high-rises, protect all your sensitive locations, high-risk locations. We didn't know where the next shoe was going to drop.
Sonny Mandel. There was a tremendous sense of urgency, but nobody was panicked. Everybody had seen some pretty mind-staggering things, but everybody was doing what they needed to be doing.
Joe Esposito. The mayor was desperately trying to get on the phone and talk to Washington.
Rudy Giuliani. They got the White House on the phone, and it was Chris Hennig, who was the deputy political director for President Bush. I asked Chris how he was. He said, okay. I said, do we have air cover? He said, it has already been requested, and it was sent out. You should see the planes in 5 or 10 minutes. I said to him, can I talk to the president? He said, you can't. We're evacuating the White House right now. Which was a very eerie feeling. I said, has the Pentagon been attacked? I had heard that rumor. Chris said, I'll always remember how he answered it because it was a very military answer. He said, affirmative.
Bernie Kerik. I've known the mayor for about 11 or 12 years, and I've never seen him look as worried or concerned about anything as much as he did when he was on the phone with the White House. He put the phone down and he said, well, that's not good at all. They've hit the Pentagon and they're evacuating the White House. It was a clear signal that this was no longer just about New York City. It was about the United States.
Michelle Cartier, Lehman Brothers, North Tower, 40th floor. I tried calling my brother James on his cellular, but he didn't pick up. I tried calling my parents, and I think their line was busy. I called my sister Marie at her job. I said, Marie, I'm evacuating the building. They don't know if it's a plane or a bomb, but I'm leaving. You have to get in touch with James. He's in the other building. We're all worrywarts for each other. We're a very tight-knit family. James was assigned to work at Aon Corporation.
John Cartier, brother of James Cartier, electrician who was working in the South Tower. He was on assignment for a company called P.E. Stone, had a contract to do some form of electrical work for Aon. Jimmy was there working on the 105th floor of the South Tower, along with a few other co-workers from P.E. Stone.
Michelle Cartier. When I made it to the last step, I remember feeling really good, like, all right, this is the last step, everybody. Then I look out into the plaza, and I pretty much see a war zone.
John Cartier. I'm Michelle and James's older brother. I'm one of 7 kids. I was working at the old New York Post building on the east side by the FDR Drive, and Jimmy called to let me know that a plane had hit Tower 1 and that Michelle was in there, and we needed to figure out a plan, get together, and handle the situation. I said to him, all right, I'm going to leave now. I'm going to get to you. I rode my motorcycle downtown, and I got to within about a block and a half of the Trade Center.
Michelle Cartier. I was out there talking with my coworkers, Barbara and Rob, about how we're going to get home. Do you think the trains are running? I'm babbling and babbling, and I see my brother John a few steps away. I remember screaming out, Jono! I hugged him. When I saw John, I was safe again. I knew everything would be okay.
John Cartier. in the midst of thousands and thousands of people evacuating, through the doings of my brother James calling me, getting me down there, I look out and here comes my sister. She just pops out of the crowd. The odds of that happening are probably, you're better off hitting the lotto.
Michelle Cartier. John filled me in on what had been going on as I was walking down the stairs. He talked about the second plane hitting. I said, second plane? Where was the first one?
Above the impact zone, victims phoned friends and family members, sharing final thoughts and love. Melissa Harrington Hughes, director of business development for a communications network service, who was only in New York for a one-day business trip and became trapped in the North Tower, called her father in Massachusetts.
Bob Harrington, father. She was a little hysterical, and I couldn't understand what she was saying, so I said, slow down a minute and tell me what the problem is so I can help you out. I said, you get to the stairwell and get out of that building as fast as you can. I told her that I loved her. She said, I love you too, Dad. And she said, you have to do me a favor. You have to call Sean and tell him where I am and tell him that I love him.
Minutes later, Hughes called her husband, Sean, still asleep in San Francisco, and left him a voicemail. She told him, I just wanted to let you know I love you, and I'm stuck in this building in New York. There's lots of smoke, and I just wanted you to know that I love you always.
John Cartier. We had four phone calls from Jimmy. One was to me, and three went to my sister Maria, that were intermittent and cut off. The last phone call that we received from him was 20 minutes before the collapse. We know that my brother was alive at that point. He said that he was with a lot of people and he was on the 105th floor. True to form, he told my sister, tell mommy and daddy that I love them and that we're gonna try to get down. That was the last time we heard from him.
Mary Massajewski, wife of Jan Massajewski, waiter, Windows on the World. North Tower, 106th floor. Jan's normal shift was lunch, so he'd get there at 10:30 a.m. But the Friday before, his manager called and asked if he could work breakfast. My office is about 10 blocks away. The minute I got to my desk, I work on the 46th floor. People were screaming and running to the windows. Then my phone rang, and it was Jan. He told me that there was smoke, awful smoke, and that they were in touch with the fire department, who told them not to move, that they were going to come and get them. I told him to go wet a napkin and put it over his face so he could breathe. He told me there was no water anywhere, and so he was going to go get some from the flower vases. Then the second building was hit, and they decided to evacuate my building. Jan told me to hang up and get out so I would be safe, and to call him back on his cell phone when I got outside. But there was no connection.
Howard Lutnick, CEO, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. We have speakerphones in each office. All of the offices across the country are connected to each other all day. The other offices heard the New York office saying, we need help, we need help, we need help. It wasn't screams. There was nowhere to go. Couldn't go down, couldn't go up.
Stephen Larrabee, Cantor Fitzgerald, L.A. office. My son Chris worked for Cantor Fitzgerald in New York. He called me right after the airplane hit the building. It was very early in Los Angeles. He said, Dad, did you hear our building was hit by an airplane? I said, no, I hadn't. Having been in that building before, I wasn't terribly concerned because I'd seen small aircraft flying by. And that's what I surmised had happened. I said, well, take care of yourself. Get out of the building, evacuate with everybody else, and give me a call after that's done. I hung up the phone and walked to get coffee. A couple of people in our trading room were either hooked up to CNN or CNBC, one of those stations, and started talking real loud. Then we realized what had happened. We had a speaker system that went to all our branch offices, and somebody in our New York office said, does anybody know we're here? Is anybody coming to get us? Then we all realized how horrible this thing was. Frank Harrison in our Chicago office said, "You guys, get on the floor, stay low, cover if you can with anything. Don't let the smoke get you." There was some crowd noise. Then it was static. The speaker system went dead.
Howard Lutnick. My brother Gary was in the building. Later that night, when I spoke to my sister, she told me that she spoke to my brother. She had said to him, "Oh my God, thank God you're not there." He said, "I am here, and I'm going to die. I wanted to tell you I love you." He said goodbye.
Beverly Eckert, wife of Sean Rooney, VP of Risk Management, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 98th floor. It was about 9:30 a.m. when he called. When I heard his voice on the phone, I was so happy. I said, "Sean, where are you?" thinking that he had made it out and that he was calling me from the street somewhere. He told me he was on the 105th floor. I knew right away Sean was never coming home. There was a building in flames underneath him, but Sean didn't even flinch. He stayed composed, talking to me the way he always did. I will always be in awe of the way he faced death. Not an ounce of fear. Not when the windows around him were getting too hot to touch. Not when the smoke was making it hard to breathe. I wanted to use the precious few minutes we had left to talk. He told me to give his love to his family, and then we began talking about all the happiness we shared during our lives together. How lucky we were to have each other. At one point, when I could tell it was getting harder for him to breathe, I asked if it hurt. He paused for a moment and then said, "No." He loved me enough to lie. In the end, as the smoke got thicker, he kept whispering, "I love you," over and over.
Terry Langone, wife of FDNY firefighter Peter Langone. "My husband called to let me know. Turn on the TV, Ter. We think a plane crashed into the towers." Then he proceeded to talk to me like it was any other day. Then he said, "Keep the TV on and watch. I'm not going to be home anytime soon." That was that. That was the last time I spoke to him. I'm one of the fortunate ones to have spoken to him that day.
John Cartier, you've got to look at the small gifts that we were given as a family. There's a lot of families out there who didn't get a last word or a last phone call. One of the other young ladies who lost a husband said it best. She said, "We were the lucky of the unlucky to have those last words." Dan Nigro, Chief of Operations, FDNY, inside the ground floor lobby of the North Tower at the FDNY command post. I said to Chief Gansey, "I am going to quickly walk around and see what the damage looks like." When I got to the center of Vesey Street, I could see clearly the north side of the South Tower. The corner of the building was taken out. We didn't see that when the plane hit. It had sliced right through the tower. I wanted to get back to say to Pete, "I think we have less time than we might have thought we had. The South Tower looks terrible."
Jean Potter. I came out of the World Trade Center at 9:55. I looked at my watch. There's flaming debris all around me. I walked one block and I saw one of my apartment building's doormen. I said, "Richard, what happened?" I turned around. The sight of the towers flaming was unbelievable. My doorman said a plane hit the World Trade Center. Then I was trying to get contact with Dan and my family because I thought, if anybody sees this, they're going to think I'm dead. Melinda Murphy. The towers were on fire. My photographer Chet had been a firefighter. He said, "The buildings are going to fall." I remember being really mad, vehemently saying, they are not going to fall down. He said, "They are going to fall. They're going to pancake down."
Dan Nigro. I heard somebody call out to me, a civilian employee of the fire department. He said, "Chief, my wife works on the 92nd floor of the South Tower, and I can't get in touch with her." It was one of those instances where you really have your hands full with what you're doing, but I thought, let me stop for a minute. I felt so bad for him. I knew his wife had given birth about 3 months before. I said, "No one's phone is working. I am sure she got out before this even happened, and she's probably already a few blocks away, so when the phones start working again, you'll be able to contact her. Don't worry." Stopping to talk to this person inadvertently saved me and my aide, who was with me, and is also my nephew, from certain death. We were walking to go through the South Tower lobby, and whatever time it took me to say those few words would have been enough time to put me in a place where I would not have been able to get away.
Bill Spade. We were right in front of Stairway C in the North Tower. The people were coming down, and we kept telling people, "You're almost out, you've almost made it out."
Lila Spessener. We got down to the concourse level. The sprinklers were on. Everything was soggy, wet, whatever. But we started to smile because, okay, we were done.
William Jimeno. We bumped into another group of Port Authority police officers. A classmate of mine, Walwyn Stewart. He actually had his first little girl while we were in the academy. We punched each other's fists and we said, "Be safe." They started walking away. That would be the last time we saw any of those Port Authority police officers.
Lieutenant Greg Hansen. Engine 24, FDNY. There was a chief on the 35th floor in the North Tower with us. Over his radio came a mayday to get out of the building. A mayday basically means to run. We didn't, at the time, have any understanding why that order was given, and it didn't make sense to us. Within seconds, the South Tower collapsed.
Something wasn't right. The first collapse. At 9:59 a.m., less than an hour after it was the second building hit, the South Tower, weakened by fires fueled by thousands of gallons of jet fuel, collapsed.
Dan Potter. I ran into the Engine 10 firehouse at the base of the World Trade Center, and Captain Mallory grabbed me and said, "Sign into the book because it's total recall. They're calling all firefighters back here." I remember signing the book and putting on my gear. Other firefighters were also starting to run in now. One of them was Pete Bielfeld. I figured he and I would team up. As we go toward the front of the firehouse, I said, "Pete, let me go grab a tool first. Stand here. Let me go grab a rescue tool." I turned around, ran back for that. He didn't wait for me. As I was going out the front of the firehouse, there was a firefighter standing in the door. I don't know who he was. I remember him standing there, looking up, and he saw the top of the tower twist. As I was going by, he clotheslined me. He sticks his arm out and catches me. He goes, "Holy shit, here it comes."
Dan Nigro. No one has heard a high-rise building collapse before. But as soon as I heard it, I knew what it was.
Donna Jensen, resident, Battery Park City. It was this rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat, this snapping sound in perfect rhythm. This loud, cracking, snapping sound.
John Cartier. At first it was a faint sound, and then it came closer and closer.
Captain Sean Crowley, NYPD. We're talking to NYPD Officer Glenn Pettit at the intersection of Liberty and West when we hear a rumble.
Edward Eddie Aswad Jr., Officer, NYPD. I'm looking at the building, and Sean's facing me. The next thing you hear is, "It's going." I look up and see this black cloud of smoke.
Captain Sean Crowley. I was looking away from the building toward Eddie. I saw his face, and he goes, "Fucking run," or something like that. He turned around and ran toward where our cars were parked, which was right in front of the Three World Financial Center, underneath the walkway. I never saw Glenn again.
William Jimeno, officer, PAPD, inside the lobby of the South Tower. Everything started shaking. I looked back toward the lobby, and I saw a fireball the size of my house coming. Sergeant John McLaughlin yelled, "Run!" I said to myself, "What did I get myself into?" As I was running, I could see a light in front of me. I remember thinking, in a split second, "Wow, I should run toward the light. Maybe it will take me outside." Then I remembered we promised we would not leave each other. I saw Dominic run. He turned to the left, so I started to follow him. At that point, all I felt was my body go up in the air and get slammed.
John Cartier. The sound was so deafening.
Michelle Cartier, Lehman Brothers, North Tower, 40th floor. This high-pitched sound. And I didn't know what that was, but it was so eerie, like your fingernails on a chalkboard type of thing.
Bruno Dellinger. I heard a sound that today I cannot remember.